Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with security shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of IGN Unfiltered. It's my monthly interview series where I have the good fortune to sit down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry. And today I'm pleased to be joined by Joe Fielder. He is a longtime game industry veteran from back in the games media days. You were once at this side of the table.
We'll get to that.
But these days you are the creative director finishing up Underworld Ascendant, the spiritual successor to Ultima Underworld, which is just an all-time great classic game. So, Joe, welcome. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
This is great. So, like I said, I mean, I have to start. I think you're the first former or current games media veteran that I've had in here. So, yeah. You know, that's I've been doing this for 16 years. You did it for a while. So, but when you were a kid, though, like, take me back further. What did you want to be when you grew up?
I really wanted to be a writer, and I was really fascinated with games, particularly games like Wizard of War, which is one of the first talking games, where as you're playing in this kind of evil space maze, you've got a evil character who's taunting you throughout the game in a sort of like proto-showdown sort of way.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I've then moved on to writing that sort of dialogue. Maybe not quite as astutely as The Wizard of War, but hopefully someday.
What were some of your other favorite games as a kid growing up?
I'm going to date myself by saying Adventure, Bard's Tale, Escape from the Mind Master, Dragon Stomper, a lot of RPGs, a lot of RPGs definitely.
Which is clearly, yeah, it's now evident in your career. That sort mm-hmm. of, that is exactly the sort of arc you've been on, but You're one for the classics for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I've been a fan of games since the start. I'm totally dating myself by saying that. I have a collection of vintage systems and the coin op in my living room.
Really?
Yeah, I have the old Wizard of War.
Wow, that's impressive. Yeah. Is that tough to maintain those things, or are they?
It would be if I did. there's definitely of the two players. If you play on the right side, one of the joysticks doesn't like to go to the right, and there's some background fuzz. So I definitely need to fix that up at some point.
I think we have a guy, Sam Claiborne, our managing editor, who I think could. He lives for that stuff. His garage is full of pinball machines.
Oh wow!
So I think he could help you out, but. Yeah, are there any other, like, can you have just one cabinet in your house, or do you kind of get the bug and you want to have more now?
They're like tattoos. You definitely want to get more once you have the first, but they're a little harder to lug around, so I would love to get a pinball machine, but, man, those things are tough to find space for.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of the old systems, like the old Bally Astrocade and things like that. They're a little easier to manage.
Do you get to spend any time actually playing them? Do you hook them back up, or are they actively hooked up somewhere?
The Wizard of War machine gets a fair amount of play.
Nice.
But some of them are down in the basement. Especially as we're finishing up a game, you don't get to play nearly as much as you'd like.
Yeah, I guess it's got to be always a good conversation starter if you have people over the house. It's just like, well, what's the deal here?
And yeah.
then you get to talk about it and talk about your love.
They don't expect it to actually work. It's funny. And, Wizard of War also has some fantastic side art and things like that. It's neat.
That's awesome. So you had a creative writing major mm-hmm. in college.
Mm-hmm.
Who were some of the works or authors that were most inspirational to you?
Geesh,
in those formative times?
I was a big fan of William S. Burroughs and writers like him from the Beats. But over time, I started to dig into noir and Coen Brothers and things like that.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff that later, working on the BioShock series was right in line with some of Ken's inspiration.
Worked out.
Yeah.
Were your parents supportive of your ambitions to get into creative writing?
Yes, definitely on creative writing. I think they were a little worried about the comics and the video games. I asked my dad if he was ever worried about me growing up, and he mentioned, only when you were playing those Dungeons & Dragons games. And I was like, oh, now I'm working on an RPG.
Yeah, I always like to ask that of guests because I know even, I'm 38, and when I was growing up, my parents were super cool with, I wanted to get into writing, and I was like, video games, and at one point I said, I'd love to combine these, and for me it ended up on this track, which, again, it started that way for you too, but... Mm-hmm. It wasn't nearly as common when we were kids, right? Of parents, a lot of parents just was like, those are just toys. Mm-hmm. So I'm always curious if you encounter resistance from your parents, or if the people I have in here, like yourself, that end up thriving, it's partial, at least in part, because their parents didn't try to shut that door and were like, yeah, we're behind you.
Yeah, no, my parents were super, super supportive of the writing, and I'm hugely appreciative of that. Yeah.
What do they think now that you're just a seasoned game developer? I feel like that's got to be a thing where they're bragging to their friends. our son makes video games.
I've had a few people bump into my dad who has the same name as me and be like, Joe Fielder, that sounds really familiar. And he was kind of enjoyed that. I put him in the credits for one of the Medal of Honors and special thanks. So he's on Moby Games.
Nice,
Joe Fielder Senior.
That's awesome. So again, as I sort of touched on at the top, you worked at GameSpot doing games media in the mid '90s. So at what point during that do you get the bug to cross over to game development, or was that bug just always there?
I was really proud of the fact that there was some developer at the time was like, oh, you game journalists just want to make games, and I was like, no, I really enjoy working as a game journalist, and it was super, super fun gig. But after about 8 years of working on magazines and websites, I really wanted to try new challenges and started working up samples in the Infinity Engine for Neverwinter Nights.
BioWare, the their tech.
Yeah, it was. I familiarized myself and kind of taught myself that engine, and when I first went to do some of my early interviews for game design, even just talking through some of the bugs and issues I came up with and how I kind of circumvented them, really helped me get my foot in the door.
That's interesting. So even when you decided to start trying to dip your toe in the water, you picked basically RPG tech.
I did.
To do it with.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was even a conscious decision on your part, or if you just sort of naturally gravitated towards
sure.
that.
That's a good question. I don't know. I felt like I knew modules pretty well, and I knew story well enough from my background, and a fun place to kind of dive in. It was funny because later on, I think Knights of the Old Republic 2 came out and had a few bugs on chip, and I was familiar with those bugs from having worked with that engine just privately. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that. Oh wow.
So it sounds like nobody like lured you into it and said, hey Joe, we think you'd be. It sounds like you kind of found your own way into it.
I definitely, every job I've ever gotten, I've looked out where people helped me with opportunities, from even the start, working on magazines and whatnot. Getting a foot in the door to work on the Medal of Honor series at EA was another former game journalist, Kevin Perry, who had made the jump from Computer Game Review and knew that people could do that, make that jump.
Right.
So, yeah.
So, looking back, are there any reviews that, now that you're on the other side making games, are there any reviews that you look back on or articles at all where you think, oh man, oh that was I didn't do that very well, or I got this wrong, or.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, over years at, working on game reviews and reviewing hundreds of games, there's probably a few in there where I'm like, oh, wow. There's definitely, when I'm talking with other developers, I try not to bring up any reviews that I may have reviewed one of their games and maybe not given it a stellar review. If Warren Spector is listening, don't go and read one of my old Deus Ex 2 reviews, Warren.
Oh, no. Do you feel like your time in games media has helped you as a game developer at all? Or
Yeah. I definitely look at things from, a reviewer standpoint. I definitely look at games from a player standpoint, from experience. And one of the first things that I worked on for games writing was developing AI VO systems, basically combat dialogue.
Yeah.
And really, one of the things that really got out of under my skin as a reviewer was if you would hear the same line of dialogue multiple times, and it really took you out of the experience.
Sure.
So every game I've ever worked on, I'm like, no, we have to make sure there's, dozens of variations, even if it's just a tonal difference.
Right.
So I definitely really think about things as far as, and how is the player going to experience this? How is the reviewer, how is anyone really going to experience this? How is it all going to come together in a coherent way?
Right. Do you read reviews of your games?
I do. Sometimes with a little trepidation, but sometimes the games that are the most fun to work on don't get the highest score, and sometimes the games that are really rough to work on get higher scores. So it's a little back and forth. You always are proud of the work, but it's somebody representing their experience with the game, so it's
yeah.
totally honest.
I'd love to hear a little bit more about the first part of that, because I can understand the games that were you kind of had to trudge through and just mm-hmm. gut it out and end up being reviewed well, because you've been through the battles and you turned out a product that people like. But you said there were times where you had a lot of fun on games that didn't necessarily end up getting reviewed super well.
Yeah.
You don't have to necessarily name any names sitting here, but I'm sort of curious what you mean by that.
Yeah, I'd say the second game that I ever worked on, Medal of Honor Vanguard, was one of the most fun games that I ever worked on because it was the first game that I got to write for.
Yeah.
I was a level designer for it. I was an associate producer for it. I helped develop the AIVO system for combat dialogue and worked with some really fantastic engineers to make that all come together. Wore a lot of hats on that. And
yeah.
It was definitely a game that it was one of the last games for the PlayStation 2, kind of an aging engine. But I learned so much, and I had a chance to really touch so many different spots of that game, and it was a great experience. It was really, really fun, and maybe in the score side, not the highest scoring game I've ever worked on.
Well, when you first cross over and you're working on a video game, after spending years reporting on them and covering them and reviewing them, like I think about that for myself sometimes. Like I love what I do. I don't necessarily have any interest in making games at this point in my life. But when I run through the scenario in my head, I feel like, man, I would just feel totally inferior on a development team because I'm just this like media lackey guy that's now in here trying to be part of the team. Like, how's your mindset when you're first making that jump from media to development? Because I'm just sort of personally, maybe no one else might care, but I'm kind of curious.
It was definitely tough. I mean, definitely going from the point where, working on GameSpot, I was doing interviews with the BBC and CNN about, my feelings on games, and then starting as a level designer and really seeing how much I didn't know about making games. It was definitely, reset on the ego.
Yeah.
But not in a totally bad way. It was really great to be able to look at it from the other angle and to really take in the whole process of making games and in a way kind of start from scratch on it.
Well, dovetailing off of something you just said is, I would say, what's the biggest thing that surprised you about game development that you didn't realize as from the journalism side?
Wow. It is a tough process. It is definitely, it is a managed disaster throughout. it's a series of putting out fires throughout and really kind of making the best decisions possible. It's tough. But it's also really fun coming up with creative solutions to tough problems, both time and manpower and whatnot, while still managing to have everything come together in a fun way and innovate. Man, it's a really challenging system. Making games is never boring.
That makes a ton of sense. I mean, there's always something new every day in some way, I'm sure, whether it's a challenge or a triumph, a breakthrough of some kind, or a new build, or what have you.
Yeah, it definitely, for making games, there's definitely, you can learn from past experiences and learn from other games and things like that, but if you're really attempting to innovate, as many of us are trying to do, you're really trying to, push and come up with things that are kind of uncharted territory. And things like for, Bioshock Infinite, there was a lot of things like with the skylines that, that was kind of hanging onto a roller coaster. Ken had a really clear vision of what he wanted to see for that, but that was really a tough thing to, bring together in a coherent, fun way.
Right.
I think it turned out pretty well.
Now, I'm not sure if I have my, correct me if my notes are wrong here. Was VMX Racing the first game that you worked on?
No.
Okay.
I did some voices for VMX Racing.
Okay.
But I also, that same developer who were nearby EGM, and they were friends of mine, I contributed for, I got scanned for a Super Nintendo game, one of the final ones, and it didn't actually come out. It was an adaptation of the Jim Valentino comic book Shadowhawk. Hmm. And I was a guy in a nuclear reactor in a lab coat who hunkered down and turned into a mutant. and I was this big on screen, but I have a really a weird walk, and you can totally see that weird walk in the game. It's funny. So... and I did. From there, I helped out with. I did a little voices for VMX Racing. The guys from Giant Bomb always give me a hard time about that.
So. I was saying so. Yeah, have you? Was there? There was probably some point where a former colleague interviewed you, and now that you were on the other side, did that ever happen? And was that sort of weird, where you had to?
I don't know that. I mean, I went on Giant Bomb recently. And we did a kind of a retrospective of days back at GameSpot, which was really fun. But not as much on the talking about the games itself.
You mentioned Medal of Honor. You got to work on the Medal of Honor series for a while.
Yeah.
Is there a favorite child of yours from that era?
There are so many of the early Medal of Honor games that I'm a huge fan of. The first two Medal of Honor games on the PlayStation are still some of my favorite shooters. Medal of Honor Frontline for the PS2 and Allied Assault for the PC.
Yeah.
Fantastic games. Definitely try to channel some of that energy for the first game I worked on, which was Medal of Honor European Assault, and also for Vanguard, too. Like I said, a little bit of later, engine at that point, but those were definitely inspirations.
Do you get to dive in and do a bunch of World War II research and for the writing and for just sort of the tone of the game at that point?
Yeah, actually, that's one of the first things I did on Medal of Honor Vanguard. There were a bunch of people who were really focusing on the vertical slice, and a lot of the other game hadn't been really planned out yet. And EA had it was around the time of Katrina. And the historian that EA had was working with was based out of New Orleans, and EA brought him out to Playa Vista. And so we had this World War II historian in the building. So I definitely tapped him for a bunch of thoughts on how that game might be structured And later on, presented that to the producer. The producer's like, did anyone ask you to do this? I'm like, I thought I was in trouble. And I'm like, no. He's like, no, it was good. He was a very soft-spoken guy. So, but yeah, I learned a lot about World War II history from that and also did a ton of research. So
it's got to be fun to just hunker down and know you're, you know, you...
I don't
learn something and express something.
I don't want to say that like research is the best part of writing because it's all fun, but it's a blast to it's kind of like a independent study for where you get to choose your own topic. If you can kind of for writing figure out like, hey, what's an era or some area of research that I'm really fascinated by, and then I can dig into that and your own fascination kind of hopefully comes out in the writing itself.
Well, maybe almost a complete 180 degree turn is Boom Blocks,
yeah,
which you also worked on. What was sort of your role on that? Because there's no character dialogue to write for that game.
Yeah. It's true. It was a little bit of a surprise when EA told me my next game was going to be Boom Blocks, I played the early demo of that game, and it was already fun. The people who had worked on the early demo of that, Doug Church, Jeff Dixon, other folks, had already just made it a fun experience. And it was definitely an interesting challenge to develop a game that was as accessible as walking up to... an arcade game in the 80s, where you just could walk up and immediately understand everything there was to do, and so that was kind of a fun challenge as a designer. That's a game that whenever I mention to people that worked on it, they're like, "Oh, I love that game." So that's always nice.
I didn't realize Doug Church worked on that. He's like the man behind the curtain of some of the greatest games. Like he seems like a very private, quiet person. Like, I don't see interviews with him, but he's a Looking Glass alumnus as well.
He's ubiquitous and mysterious, yes.
Yeah.
He's definitely had his hand in some really fantastic games, and a really great developer.
Did you ever get a chance to work with Steven Spielberg at all on it? He is not the kind of guy, from my understanding, that just slaps his name on it. Like he is a gamer, and he was involved, very much involved in Boom Blocks.
Yeah, there's a lot of times when celebrities are attached to games, and they don't really they might have some deadlines, and they kind of blow. But Spielberg, he came up with the initial idea of throwing the ball and would check in regularly. There was definitely. It was great to be able to tell my dad, Steven Spielberg stopped by my desk the other day. He's a gamer. He actually told a story about how he first got introduced to games, which he was working on Jaws, and Richard Dreyfuss said, "Oh, come here, you gotta check this out." And he and Steven Spielberg went off and played Pong on one of the piers until the machine was full of quarters and couldn't play anymore. So that was his in for video games.
That's cool. That's a great story. I love that. So when did you join Irrational Games? And were you a fan of Ken Levine's prior to that? Or what sort of, how do you find your way into Irrational?
I lucked out in that, people put in a good word for me, friends that I had worked with on previously, and got the interview to go out and talk with them. And I didn't actually know what I was interviewing for at the time. There were rumors about it being the XCOM first-person shooter.
Right.
And it was, I think, about 3 hours into the interviews when they finally said, "Oh, I guess we should tell them what this is. It's BioShock 3." It was a really great opportunity. It was after I left EA. I came on board as a producer, and then later switched over to writing full time.
Yeah. So, I mean, Ken, who I've had the pleasure of speaking to him many times over the years. Still want to try and get him in that chair, though, to put in a good word for me on that if you can. But, he's regarded as one of the luminaries and geniuses of this industry. What is he like to work for?
I think that Ken is one of the best writers in the industry, if not the best. I think he's a Coen Brothers level writer, and working with him on BioShock Infinite was a was a real fantastic opportunity. I learned a ton from him. I got to, at one point, you know, write for the Splicers in that, and I'd done a pass on that, and him and the other one of the other writers, Drew Holmes, gave me feedback, and Ken opened up his kind of playbook on how he came about writing the Splicers and some of the influences, you know, Requiem for a Dream and other things like that.
Yeah.
Willie Loman and... really, you know, I had written characters who had been kind of, they had said sort of nasty or funny things, and he was like, no, you have to feel sympathy for them. For horror, you really need to have some sense of empathy, otherwise it's just scares. And that meeting, I felt like, taught me a ton about writing and game writing in particular.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow... grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
What does Colgate mean by live life to the brightest? Could it be a rich glass of red sipped inside a Parisian cafe on a snowy night when my gaze is met by a tall, mysterious... I mean, brushing is directed with Colgate Optic White Pro Series toothpaste gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 3 days, so you can live life to the brightest and finish that glass without worrying about teeth stains. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click.
Click, click, click.
Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Do you remember the moment when you read what, presumably the last page of Infinite Script? Like, does Ken hand it to you? Do you get like, because that, I mean, as a player, mm-hmm. when we got to the end of it, mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was a wow moment for sure. It was one of the coolest moments in video game storytelling that I had experienced up to that point. So you obviously had to find out about it. Your own way, not mm-hmm. through, probably not through playing it. I'm sure, you know, you read it on a page.
That's a good question. I don't remember when I first heard of that or saw of it. You know, there are a number of times that were really memorable throughout the course of the 6 years I worked on Infinite. Like, I was part of the casting session with Troy Baker and Courtney Draper And, it was clearly there was a really interesting magic for both of those performers.
Yeah.
And Courtney had this amazing empathetic feel to her voice. The ending, I don't know where I was when I learned about that. There's many, many moments of... I think there was one of my favorite moments was we were about to go into do some recording for one of the early demos of the game. It was the first demo that had the Assault Install character.
Mm-hmm.
We were just about to record and we didn't have the final script. And I was talking with Ken over the phone and he basically transcribed the speech for Assault Install. And he just made it seem easy. Like, it's such a fantastic speech. Amity and Gold, and when I've talked to him afterwards, he was like, "Oh yeah, it took me days to finally come up with that." But at the time, I was like, "It seemed like it was totally off the cuff."
Yeah,
yeah,
that's so cool. So you wrote the companion book for Infinite called Mind in Revolt. Did you find that easier or harder than working on the game itself?
That was really fun. It's the pretty short prequel novella. It's only about 80 pages altogether, but it was fun to have a chance to kind of dig a little deeper with some of the characters. But I would say harder. I don't know that it was tougher. Definitely challenging in different ways. The challenges of writing chapter to chapter versus, you get to do some sort of like bite-sized narrative of working with games.
Yeah.
They both have their interesting challenges.
Yeah. I mean, do you get to? I'm in my head, I see it as more of a sort of isolated solo experience versus the game is super collaborative.
Mm-hmm.
Or am I totally wrong? And is the book, is it just as collaborative is working on the game?
I mean, definitely working on a book you can kind of hide out and write for a period of time, and you're definitely getting feedback. But, writing for games, you are definitely more collaborative where, you might have a first pass at writing. You get that in and test it out, see what works. Sometimes you are building off the strengths of some of the things that the level designers have come up with, or in some cases, working on Medal of Honor Vanguard was great because I got to write for Yuri Lowenthal, who was, of course, the voice of Peter
Spider-Man,
Parker,
yeah,
in Prince of Persia. He had actually come in, he'd already been cast for voices for some of the German characters for AIVO because he's multilingual. And when we got him into the studio, it was like, wait, you were the Prince of Persia? I'm totally writing all of this stuff for you in mind. So,
yeah.
Get to kind of write to different talents and, adapt to, the folks you're working with.
Do you bother to read, do you read any other sort of game companion, prequels or novels? Drew Karpyshyn did a really good Mass Effect prequel novel that I read before playing Mass Effect. Or, mm-hmm. or do you just, you kind of not worry about that and just do your own thing?
I think for the most part, it's more digging into some of the research. 1915 was such an amazing time to really dig into. Devil in the White City, of course, was a big inspiration. But a lot of primary research, newspapers of the time, trying to get a cadence to the speech. But it's often in some cases, it's writing to people's perception of how people spoke at the time.
Yeah.
That was something that Ken talked about for Bioshock, was that he found that in actual research that people wrote formally, but they spoke very casually. In early testing, people felt like, oh, it didn't sound right to them. So, he adapted accordingly. And we did the same sort of thing for Bioshock Infinite, where I'm not sure if it's completely accurate for how people spoke in 1915, but it's a reasonable proximity.
Right. That's interesting. I never even thought about that. How do you feel about Bioshock Infinite in hindsight? Now that's, we're a number of years removed from it.
Wow, I mean, it was, like I said, a fantastic opportunity to learn about making games. You know, look back at working on the DLC really fondly. I look back at, you know, working with the voice performers really fondly. So much of the craft that, I've been able to pick up is from that. And working with, a lot of the former Looking Glass sort of folks, mm-hmm. There's a lot of those core philosophies that were, you know, definitely underlying and at Irrational, and I've had a lot of luck to work with a lot of former Looking Glass
folks. Yeah, were you caught up in the big Irrational restructuring that ended up happening there, or had you moved on by that point?
I was part of that, and at that point went over to do freelance full time for some time, and then tried to do the Kickstarter for the Black.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you about next. What was that project? It ended up, you know, obviously it didn't make it. It was 2015 is when the end of the road came for it. But yeah, what was the Black Glove?
The Black Glove was sort of a more experimental, narrative focused game. Working with a lot of folks who were former Irrational, a lot of voice talent that I'd worked with both at EA and at Irrational. Yuri Lowenthal was the main character in that, and his wife, Tara Platt, was the other co-lead in that game. It was a real attempt, to take some of our severance money and try to kick off a new company and get some crowdfunding. It was ended up being towards the tail end of crowdfunding being a kind of viable option, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But I still get people frequently writing me like, "Hey, when is the Black Glove coming back?" which is great. It was fun to work on. We had still had a lot to learn about how that game would come together. And it's hard to pitch a game when you're still kind of figuring out a lot of those things, especially if it's not based on a previous series or
makes
things
sense.
Like that.
Yeah. So now you're not here for your health. We're promoting Underworld Ascended.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the monitor behind you there. It's the spiritual successor to Ultima Underworld, one of the most beloved, greatest games of all time, certainly greatest RPGs. You have two other game industry luminaries that you are able to call colleagues now in the form mm-hmm. of Paul Neurath and Warren Spector.
Mm-hmm.
What have you learned from them?
And I would add to that Tim Stomach, who is our lead designer and was also the lead designer of Thief, worked on
wow.
System Shock, is somebody who I learn about game design from every time I talk to him. But all of those folks and others at Other Side, have backgrounds in Looking Glass or Irrational or both.
Yeah.
And it's hard not to nerd out a little bit when people talk about the early days working on Thief. But I've worked with Paul for a few years now, who is kind of one of the unsung heroes of game development. He's a co-founder of Looking Glass,
yeah.
designed the first few levels of Ultima Underworld. And got the chance to work with Warren Spector on the narrative for Underworld Descendant, it's really day by day, hour by hour basis. Looking Glass was just we were talking earlier, and a lot of those folks were former MIT. They brought a lot of intellect and logic
for
to
sure.
making immersive sims. It ends up that making games that are based on logical simulations, having a strong logic background really helps. For all of those folks and for working at Ken, just the approach of hey, what are we trying to solve? What are we what's the most logical way of clearly getting these things across, and how to really make the best game possible. It's there's a lot that I think Looking Glass, when people talk about those days, it seems like a video game grad school. Or
yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So,
do you have a favorite Looking Glass game, just personally?
Geesh, I would say Ultima Underworld. It was actually a game that I had not played as a kid.
Yeah.
I was playing, I think I'd gone back and forth between PC games and console games at the time. I was playing console games when it came out, but I played it, a few years ago, and I was amazed by not only, how well it held up, but how many, you can clearly see how it influenced games like Bioshock,
sure.
System Shock,
oh, yeah.
The Morrowind series. But there are elements of that game that nobody has really followed up on. And, you know, we're attempting to for Underworld Ascendant. Just an incredibly innovative game. So,
how much inspiration do you take from the System Shocks and Ultima Underworlds for Ascendant versus trying to not be so worried about the past and make something for 2018?
Well, I would say that Underworld Ascendant is definitely everything that we've learned about making games from series like System Shock, BioShock, Thief, Ultima Underworld, you know, clearly. But the original Ultima Underworld was, like I said, an incredibly innovative game, so we're really looking at how can we innovate in different ways as well. We're a 14-person team altogether. We're definitely an indie-sized project. We're going up against a lot of teams that are, 300, 400 and more folks. So we're really, during Underworld Ascendant, we really tried to look at, what can we do differently? What are the opportunities out there? What are things that we'd like to see in games? In a lot of the big RPGs, you can explore for miles and miles and miles, but the environments feel a little static over time.
Yeah,
you're lucky if you go to you get a repop if you go back to an area. We really saw an opportunity where with our size team we could make a smaller world but have it be constantly evolving, so every time you return to an area, if you chose to, you'd have new challenges and opportunities. There's a degrading world state, so over time, creatures that are normally associated with the lower depths of the Stygian Abyss start crawling their way up. And in some of those elements, actually, there's a lot of really fantastic game design in a lot of modern board games. Games like Eldritch Horror, Mansions of Madness. They do a lot of repeatable narrative in really innovative ways. And, was really looking at how we could apply some of those principles. So it's a mix of, game series we've worked on, what other people aren't doing, and what are really exciting design innovations that we can kind of try to incorporate.
How much line walking do you have to do between, serving old school Ultima Underworld fans versus, trying to bring in a new audience?
It's tough because Ultima Underworld did so many things right that what really stood out about that game varies from person to person. In some cases it might be a certain quest or the feeling of immersion or the feeling that sort of, it had a lot of survival elements. There's definitely elements of the game that we took direct inspiration from in the game in Underworld Ascendant. We wanted to really evidence elements of the immersive sim, so that people could really have fun and experiment in ways that you might have to dig and dig and dig to find the kind of the depth in some of the Looking Glass games. So in the game, we present you with interesting challenges, and the game provides you with a wide bevy of tools. And then however you solve those challenges is up to you.
Yeah, it's a systems-based role-playing game, effectively. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, totally. And that was definitely the case for the original Looking Glass games. But the game rewards you for creativity, for engaging with the systems in interesting ways.
Yeah.
And what we've tried to really double down on is that sort of experimental gameplay and digging into... I mean, we have dozens of different skills and abilities like combat, stealth, magic. There's a procedural-based magic system like in the original game. That's one thing that we definitely, took directly from the original game.
Yeah.
And there's a meta element of a silver sapling from the original game where you basically have this magical device or magical artifact you can plop down and put a respawn point anywhere where there's a ground. So if you want to, attempt something kind of audacious and see if you can get away with it, if I don't pull it off, I can restart back there.
Has Richard Garriott seen the game yet?
I'm not sure. We do have I was just mentioning earlier today, we do have a callback for the first line in Ultima Underworld is Treachery and Doom, voiced by Richard Garriott. And there's I think the first bit of graffiti you come across in the game is someone has written Treachery and Doom. It wasn't me at all, I swear. but yeah, there's definitely like we definitely want to make a game that if you haven't played the Ultima Underworld games, that you can pick up and have fun immediately. And there's a larger storyline that you can kind of pick up on. If you are a fan of the earlier games, there are plenty of hooks. There are a lot. I'm a comic book continuity nerd, so there are a lot of references to the early games.
Have you had a chance, either by sort of coincidence, just playing stuff, or maybe specifically research-based, to go back, to go and look at some of the more recent remakes or revivals, whether it's Doom from 2016, after such a long hiatus with Doom, or even like the Shadow of the Colossus remake or anything like that, to sort of look at how other teams have sort of brought something beloved back for modern times? Or do you kind of just prefer to clean sheet it, close yourself off, and not be influenced by what someone else may or may not have done?
I mean, I think you're always influenced by, a lot of games you're playing. I'm a huge fan of, the modern Doom. Really, really fun game. I wouldn't say I was directly influenced, though there's some fantastic level design in that game. It's really making a game is a matter of, like, trying to figure out, like, what are the most interesting challenges, and then really trying to make good on those challenges. You're kind of trying to, set a high bar, for design, for writing, for, the experience. And if you have that bar to try to clear, you're like, oh, if I can hit that, this game will be amazing.
So it's no secret, you kind of hinted at it yourself, you're coming out at a very busy time, a lot of these heavy hitters coming out. The game is, as this interview airs, the game's out this week. So give folks the sales pitch. Like, because it's, I feel like, you're a 14-person team. You don't have the $50 million marketing budget behind you, but I have seen the game at various stages. You actually were reminding me, like, oh, we met 3 years ago, seeing an early version of the game at PAX East. So there is a lot. I feel like there is a lot here that gamers will really like if they give it a shot. So what is the elevator pitch, ultimately, to get people to give Underworld Ascendant a look?
Yeah, well, I would say that if you are a fan of game series like System Shock, BioShock, Thief, you'll be interested in Underworld Ascendant. If you're looking for an RPG that's doing things differently, it's a game for you. And we're an indie title. It's also indie priced. It's only $30, so
can't beat that.
I think it's a competitive in that way. And if you, like I said, if you're fans of Dishonored, BioShock, System Shock, that sort of game, we're the only game that's coming out this year that's along those lines.
Yeah, so. Steam at first.
We're coming out November 15th on PC and consoles next year.
Great. That's actually I was going to ask you. So that's cool that you've got the console versions will be coming a little later.
Yep.
We're 14-person team's got only so much bandwidth at a time, I presume.
It's true. We wear a lot of hats, but you can only wear so many hats at a given time.
Sure. So as with the game coming out this week as we air this, what's it feel like to have a project be done? Is it pure relief? Is it anxiety written somehow? I'm sort of curious what that is like.
It's working on immersive sims, there are a lot of elements that don't really come together till the end, and that's something that Paul Nureth talked about for Thief, where the stealth systems didn't really come together in a coherent way until the final few months of that project, which must have been immensely stressful. And in our game we have stealth, we have combat, we have magic, you don't have prescribed character classes, you can mix and match however you want, the immersive sim qualities, there's so many systems that are interlocking, and it's been so satisfying over recent months to see all those systems come together and be polished. The team has just done stellar work making everything come together, and it's been an honor working with them. It's really it's also a huge relief as well.
So are you the kind of person now that this is another question I always like to ask everybody, is when you're done, you've given three something years of your life to this project, are you gonna tropical island this thing and just unplug and go away for a little while, or do you kind of just like to just stay dug in and see what people are doing with it? What's your next move for the immediate short term of finishing this project?
I mean, I'm looking forward to taking off a weekend. I've been putting in a lot of hours and really just trying to make the game as best as I can in the time we have. And then we do have further updates planned beyond. We haven't talked about DLC yet, but really, I can't wait to see people play the game because this whole time, every time we've brought in new external testers or we've shown at PAX, we've seen people come up with solutions that we've never thought of before. When you have all these systems that are based off altering physics and physical properties, you give all these people all these tools. They figure out solutions you really haven't even occurred to you.
Yeah.
And that's been satisfying. And then I can't wait to see what people come up with on streams. You know, it's definitely, I've worked on a lot of games that had kind of like one set way of beating the game, and this is totally doubles down on player choice. And even at PAX, we would see people come up with solutions, like five different solutions for solving one of the early rooms. I can't wait to see all the madcap stuff people come up with.
It does seem like you're hitting at the right time in the sense of, like, gamers now love that open-ended choice and sort of, there's inherent replayability in Ascendant with the 6,000 different ways you can approach any given problem. So
that's one of the things we set out really early to do, was to make a game that you could play multiple times over and have a really uniquely different experience. You can really double down on combat, you can really double down on stealth, or you can mix and match. The game narrative adapts to a lot of your choices within the game. There are definitely, main act events, but when you are given, when you take on a contract for one of the three factions within the game, it's literally however you choose to solve it is up to you. We've had people like, "Oh, I can't wait to break your game," but like, no, you have the tools. Like, however you do it is completely up to you.
So, do you now, when you do take a little break, you come back, do you get to go help Warren Spector on System Shock 3, or what's next for Joe Fielder at this point?
We'll see about that. I know I would love to get a shot to write for Shodan, one of the most beloved characters in games, and both Ken Levine and Austin Grossman set a really high bar. I did get a chance to write for Terry Brosius for Underworld Descendants. She's one of the voice performers in the game, and really a really fantastic person. That was great. So I hope I get to write for Terry some more.
Excellent. Well, Joe Fielder, thank you so much. Underworld Ascendant is out now as you hear this. Go check it out on PC. As Joe said, $30. And it's going to give you a ton of replayability, ton of time, systems-based role-playing game, exactly what people love right now. So give it a look. I know it's the big fall season, but I think you're not going to disappoint people based on the bits and pieces I've seen so far. Joe, thank you so much. Really appreciate you making the trip out here.
Thanks for having me.
This was great. For much more from the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry, I've got new episodes of IGN Unfiltered every month, so stay tuned on IGN, YouTube, or your favorite podcast service as well.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.